Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Jennifer Kayong Lee, your host, and with me here are Seon J. An and Archana Madhavan, who together co-translated a collection of poems titled Glory Hole, originally written by Kim Hyun in Korean. This English language translation was published by Siegel Books in 2022, while the Korean was published in South Korea by Munji Publishing in 2014. Glory Hole is a fantastical collection of queer poems that are uncomfortable, bodily, fluid-filled, and delightfully puzzling to read. Thank you so much for joining me, Seon and Archana.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So I was wondering if you could begin by telling us a bit about yourselves, as well as your own paths to becoming translators.
Seon, you want to go first?
yeah, it happened. I'll go first. My name is Seon An. My middle name is Jung, and that is my legal name, so I didn't make that up. So I sometimes go by Suhyun Jung-an, Suhyun Jae-an. I'm a PhD student in East Asian Studies. For my research, I actually don't work on Korean literature or contemporary Korean culture. I work on what people usually think of as pre-modern stuff. Specifically, I work on Confucian philosophy from Ming and Qing and Joseon dynasties. And I'm interested in moral philosophy as well as political and legal philosophies in both historical and contemporary contexts. That said, I translate for fun, and this doesn't mean I take literary translation lightly. It's just that I have another passion that doesn't converge with contemporary Korean literature. So how did I get involved in literary translation? I think I was naturally drawn to it for two reasons. First, I've been always interested in languages, and this includes literature, but also foreign languages and even non-natural language. I also love different modes of expression. For my research, I try to be clear, precise, and concise, but I equally love being destructive, disruptive, playful in an artistic context. And so, yeah, I think poetry as a genre and translation as an activity capture the essence of a language and the playfulness of a language specifically. And second, this one is a little bit more complicated and personal. So since when I was 5, I've always written poems and short stories, and I wrote well for my age. But all of this was done in Korean because I grew up in Korea. And then I moved to the United States when I was a mid-teenager, and I didn't have a language barrier, actually, because I started to learn English when I was 5, and I was going to school with American curriculum with American teachers before I came to the United States, but I felt like I was losing the emotive part of language, so for the first 2 years, I continued to write short stories and poems, but I just felt like I couldn't do it. It's just not there. And I felt like I was losing Korean at the same time. I could read newspapers, of course, but those little nuances and sensitivity, I felt like I no longer have that. So I struggled a little bit, and I stopped writing short stories or poetry all together for like 5 years. And I think it was in the second year or third year in university, I felt like I want to write again. I was encouraged by some of the professors to take creative writing seriously, and I also developed more of sensitivity to the language. And but I was a little afraid to go back to writing altogether, so I started with translation. I felt like I could use Korean language as a vehicle, and the Korean poets, well, they are better writer than me, right? So I felt like I could use that as resources, and I think it worked well. I really enjoyed it, and I could focus on the language itself. And so I ran a translation blog called On Translation, and I translated a lot of Korean poems, and somehow people liked it. So I got several more gigs, and I also started a literary journal called Nabilera Contemporary Korean Literature, where I and other translators translated works of young Korean writers, and that's where I met Archana as well. So yeah, that is my journey. It's more about the identity struggle, I guess. Yeah.
Oh yeah, thank you for that. That I actually I can relate to a lot of what you said, Soo-hyun, especially around writing and poetry and feeling like you lost a little bit of that and then coming back to it through translation for sure. So yeah, I can start. My name is Archana. I've been translating from Korean into English since 2019, and I've been learning Korean for over a decade now. So my background actually has nothing at all to do with translation or writing. I studied molecular biology in undergrad, and then I was in a PhD program for immunology at Stanford, which 3 years into it decided academia was not for me. So I left with my master's degree. And now I work as a learning experience designer at a software company. And that basically means I create a lot of e-learning and training content on how to use our software. So my day job is very different from translation. But yeah, I guess my journey started with learning Korean, which I fell into it almost on accident. I've always really loved languages. I grew up multilingual. And I was actually learning Japanese at the time when I watched this really cheesy Korean horror movie that my friend recommended to me. And I remember just really liking the way the language sounded. And I think the sounds of languages have always been the first thing that's attracted me to it and have made me want to learn them. So I started watching a lot of Korean dramas back when you could still find them on YouTube and illegally and stuff. So I used to watch them there. And then I stumbled on this podcast about teaching yourself Korean. And I just started listening to it casually. And honestly, it felt like I absorbed the language so fast over the years. But, you know, I kind of had like this pretty immature understanding of translation. You know, once I got to a point where I could read novels in Korean, I was very kind of, oh, well, why would I ever read anything in translation now? I could just read the original work. But I think I started thinking about translation after I read The Vegetarian in English. So, you know, after The Vegetarian won the Booker Prize, Booker International Prize, I started just following a lot of the praise and criticism around Deborah Smith's translation. And I grew pretty interested in translation as a craft and practice. So I started reading more about translations. I started reading translators' notes a little bit more carefully. I was in a workshop trying to just learn translation. I did the workshop through Catapult, which was like an introduction to translation workshop. And it was in 2019, I believe, that I reached out to Soo-hyun, who was the editor-in-chief of Nabilera at the time, and told him I was interested in translation opportunities. And my first major translation was part of the novella Hongagi Den Sanai by Oh Han-ki, the man who became a flamingo. And my first attempt at translating poetry came with translating Dai Pingyi by Jin Eunyoung, Snail by Jin Eunyoung for Chogwa. And so that just kind of, you know, it started with that. I went on to translate some webtoons for some period of time and started to, I think of translation now as an expression of kind of the best parts of English and Korean coming together in one act for me. And, you know, just everything I cherish about both languages. And so I really, really enjoy the process of translation, probably even more than the end result. So I just feel like it's an opportunity for me to really come close to the languages and express myself. So yeah, that's a little bit about me. And I still do some translation outside of work. So yeah, I hope to continue that in the future. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you so much. I love how vibrantly both of you have been able to describe like kind of the emotional component and like the parts of translation that are about like working our way through like our relationships to multiple different languages. Because I think like Archana was describing, like when I was younger, like I had this kind of naive conception of translation as like, well, they just took something in one language and put it in another. But then as I got older, and I think in many of the ways both of you have described, there's just so many facets of it that are not about like the mechanical reproduction of something in one language and another.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'll start with our usual big question about this book. So what brought you to this project of translating Glory Hole?
I think I can start because, you know, I have a more superficial answer, like a factual part of it, and also like, you know, my personal like a experience. So the factual part. So I featured Kim Yun's poems in Nabulera, and sometime later I got an email from Bishan from Sequel Books, and that should be like in 2019, I think. Anyway, he told me he read the magazine and he wants to feature Kim's poetry collection for the Pride list. And it's a series of queer literature around the world translated into English, and I said, yeah, of course, I'm thrilled. And since I had translated the poems in the magazine, I decided to translate the collection. But after translating like one third, I figured that Kim's poems are much harder to translate than I had thought. So I asked Archana to join because she has pure talent, and I was really impressed by her translation. She captures the nuances in the Korean text perfectly, and she knows how to render it beautifully in English. So yeah, I had no doubt about her. So that's what happened factually. And I think this has a more fundamental like sub question, like what drew us to Kim's poems in the first place. And I think I was captivated by Kim Yun's style. It's destructive. It destroys imagery. It destroys common sense. It defies the line between fiction and reality much more so than most other poems I've read. And it defies the syntax. And yet the destructiveness and the fragmented imagery somehow makes sense. And it feels really powerful in a creative way. So I was so into it.
Yeah, it's beautifully put. Nothing to add, really. Yeah, I was super surprised and grateful when Soo-hyun reached out to me. I hadn't read anything of Kim Hyun's poetry and didn't really know much about him. And honestly, hadn't really read a lot of poetry until then. I was just getting started sort of reading Korean poetry through recommendations I got from other translators who translated for Chogwa and other poetry and writers I had read on Nabulera. So I'm super grateful for the trust and the opportunity for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And what was the process of co-translating like then?
Oh, I can start with this. You know, I first of all will say I have so much gratitude towards towards Soohyun for his patience. And he was not only, you know, a great co-translator, but he was also a coach almost through a lot of really terrifying and debilitating self-doubt that I was experiencing through translating this work. And I will also add, the bulk of our work took place in 2020 during some of the worst times of COVID-19. Mm-hmm. I personally lost two relatives that year, and there were wildfires in California. Things were very unstable with my day job. And on top of this being just a really extremely challenging work, I mean, I remember Soohyun being like, this is probably the hardest thing you will translate in a really long time. It was a lot. And, you know, I definitely look back on that time and I think that, you know, I could have been a better co-translator. I think we could have been kinder to each other during that time. But I think we really did work well together. The times that that we came together, I feel like the translations that we did together were really, really great. So one incident that I remember is, you know, Soohyun would tag me in comments and be like, hey, you know, I think this is a pun or this is a metaphor that Kim Hyun is deliberately subverting. Is there an expression you can think of that evokes this imagery or this sound? And here are some things I came up with. What are your thoughts? And actually, I pulled out one example of this was in the poem Mr. Withers of Withering Wood, which was in Korean, Shido Shido Shiden Supe Shiden Si in Korean.
Oh, wow. That's incredible.
The decision to translate Shiden Si to Mr. Withers was something that we came up with together after discussing, you know, how we could preserve the alliteration and the wordplay in the title. And I think that's probably one of my favorite things that we did in this collection. So, yeah.
Cool. Yeah. So to answer your question, the process of co-translating was basically what Archana described. It's you discuss with each other. So it's actually the system I adopted in Nebulera because mm-hmm. I believe anyone can benefit from working together. So there, a translator would translate a work and the reviewer would juxtapose it with the original work and critique the translation. And after then, the translator and reviewer would discuss and come up with a better translation. But for Glory Hole, I figured I need more than a reviewer. This is a really intense work with a lot of cultural references, twists, and other experimental elements. So I definitely needed a co-translator. So basically, for Glory Hole, I translated a portion of the collection, and Archana did the same. And we went over each other's translation and critiqued it, and I would ask questions if I need help. And so, yeah, this process is super important because the collection shouldn't sound like it was written by two different people. And it does improve the quality of the translation. And as Archana said, I really enjoyed working together. And Archana said I was being kind, but I was just being truthful. She is a really nice translator, and I had to say that. And I was a little worried that, you know, Archana might leave this industry altogether because, you know, I think Korean literary translation circle would benefit a lot from her. And I'm glad that she came back, and she's a lot more active than I am. So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Soohyun really like brought me, I think, into this world, and just, yeah, opened me up to this experience. And I feel like I grew a lot as a translator through our interactions and, you know, far from leaving the translation world, I'm now reading more poetry, more kind of involved in the contemporary works and new writers and things like that. So, you know, I feel like you really kickstarted whatever I have to contribute in this industry.
Yeah. I'm glad.
And I'm so excited to see like the future things you will translate. So, what were your favorite parts, each of you, of translating Glory Hole?
So for me, you know, it was less about the actual translation and more about almost this detective work that I was doing to uncover all of the references within a single poem. I mean, Kim Hyun puts often puts real people in these fictionalized or fantastical situations. Like, he refers to a lot of filmmakers and writers and actors, often in sort of surreal situations, and he slightly changes or subverts real historical events or real works of art. And so uncovering those references and recognizing what the author was doing and deliberately kind of overturning what we expect, it was a lot of fun. And I always felt like I uncovered this layer that was previously felt opaque to me. That was probably my favorite part. Yeah.
My favorite part, I think, I enjoyed the part Archana said as well, but that was a little bit of headache for me. So. I was struggling, and Archana, she just like magically showed up with all of these like references, and I'm like, I'm so glad. I think the part I really enjoyed was the translation, I thought of this translation as destroying the convention with the poet. So, as I said, the content is bewildering for me and probably for other Korean readers as well. And so, yeah, you read the line and you go, how does that even make sense? But when they're put together, Kim makes them disturbingly sensical, and they shouldn't make sense, but somehow they do. And I needed to recreate that experience for English readers. But the hard part is that you can't simply destroy every single word and line. You're not reading a line written by an aphasia patient. And nor is Kim's line, like, you know, Chomsky's famous example, colorless green ideas sleep furiously. It is more sensical than that. So you need to find a balance between being sensical and nonsensical. And just like the poet did, you need to capture the fragility of the language and be fragile yourself. So basically, Kim Yeon was being playful, so I was allowed to be and had to be playful too. And I think that was the best part.
Yeah. I mean, I think just reading them, like, the playfulness was there. Like, I was confused, but they were playful. And so, yeah, I think you really captured that. So we've heard a lot about the complexities and the fun of translating. So I was wondering if you could each kind of share with us a translation from the collection, so listeners can really get a sense of the atmosphere and the language of these poems which you've been describing.
Cool. I'll start because I have the first poem of the collection. So it's titled Inhumane. Inhumane. Having drifted, the night returns. A ragged human steps into a dark, crawling tub. From the tip of the human toe that touches water for the first time, fish scales break out in the shade of mugwort. The human, for the first time in a while, is soaked in the slimy sensation. Fins are more suitable for humans than two legs. The human repeats. Perching on the bed, the human elongates his neck. Scouting around the meal that several can share, the stretched neck and head sweep swollen dust and glide into a bathroom. The flowing face follows the human fin. The human takes a breath and holds it with his gills. You've lost human breath, human. The human's face radiates like pewter. The nape of the human neck is torn in the shade of lead. A fading little human comes to the tearing human and sits. As he unevenly cuts his growing tongue, the little human, for a change, tries to invent words that a human cannot comprehend. A human needn't speak human words. The stretched human wriggles. The disappearing human tongues stutter. The mutated human moves much more naturally, and they are at rest. The topwater surface is pushed into the night's slumber. The altitude of the returned night delves deep like a construction crane. Humans separately discover their lives. Humans separately hang out as humans do. Human words that are absent from the human have no meaning. Humans are quiet. They are silent. A ghost that's on strike enters the house without a shadow and illuminates the labor of a candle. Human, human, human disappears like a period mark. There are five footnotes attributed to the title, and I'll read them in the order. One, from humans, a night has emerged. Two, tonight, the rally of humans make the poet take the lead. Three, night humans chant a disabled slogan, we also want to become humans. Four, a novelist from a human perspective writes a poem titled, A Human About a Night. Five, into the night of humans who have lost a human, a sack of ghosts is walking as though it will be blown away. That's the end of it.
Wow, thank you for that.
Okay, I will read Ashes of Time, which is one of my favorites in this collection. Ashes of Time. As Ouyang Feng walked the desert where once had been an ocean, he thought, if I went back in time, I'd be able to stroll along the beach thick with peach blossoms and see the season's first snowfall with Leslie Cheung. But isn't that impossible for me? Ouyang Feng stopped walking and dug a hole in the sand. He buried a piece of white bone from his neck. A puddle formed. He wet his throat. The puddle dried up. How many more collarbones would he need to leave this planet of sand? Ouyang Feng moved his body, which was slowly becoming boneless. The sun pursued him doggedly. Ouyang Feng sagged little by little to the ground. Tomorrow I will reform into tomorrow's skeleton. Ouyang Feng stared into the hole in the sand where the pale pink salt water should have been sloshing around. Softly, a single petal of a peach blossom appeared like a mirage and then vanished without a trace. Would that I could nullify the time slipping away from us. Ashes of time in the sky grew apart and the night rolled in. Ouyang Feng pulled the bamboo hat over his eyes and thought of time. Everything is my fault. Ouyang Feng pulled a red pouch from the depths of his chest. He opened the pouch. It was an ankle bone from time that he had received from Leslie Cheung. He put his lips to the bone and smelled a light floral fragrance. Everything turned back into the oceans of time. Ouyang Feng faultlessly collapsed into the sand hole where the darkness was flailing. His skin turned red and ripe until the sun set and the moon rose. It turned blue and cooled off. Ouyang Feng's moist pupils looked like tide pools that had just formed. His eyes soon vanished. The sandstorm that carries his bones began to form Ouyang Feng's ankle bones. And now the footnotes. One, back in the day, I used to look at the mountain and wonder what was over it. Two, I don't know why I did that. I couldn't help myself. When I left, I felt his tears on my face, drying. Three, the first day of spring had passed. It is now the day on which insects wake. Friends usually came to see me around this time, but this year they did not. Four, I thought I had won. But one day I looked into the mirror and realized I had lost, because when I was at my most beautiful, the one I loved was not by my side. Five. They say the reasons humans suffer so much is because of memory. That year onward, I forgot many things and only remembered that I loved peach blossoms. Six. The only thing I can do for something I do not have is not forgetting it. Seven. If a sword cuts fast enough, the sound of gushing blood sounds pleasant, like a breeze. I never thought I would hear that sound coming from my own blood. 8. The flag does not move. The breeze does not move either. Only your heart moves. And that's it.
Thank you. Yeah, so for both of you, you read poems that have that, or you read the poem and then you read the footnotes. Mm-hmm. So one of the many formally interesting features of the poems in Glory Hole is all of these footnotes. So I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about them and if there were any that were particularly memorable to translate.
All of them were pretty hard, to be honest. And, I remember trying to count the poem that doesn't have footnotes. And mm-hmm. there were very few. I think there were one or two, and I was devastated. This is so hard. So I don't know if there is particularly memorable one. It's just all of them were hard, but I do remember in certain instances, as I said earlier, I was struggling with a lot of references, and Archana showed up and she solved a lot of problems I had. I think the hard part is that footnote pretends to provide an explanation to fiction, but they are themselves fictitious. So even figuring out if the footnote is making a reference or not was hard. If you know that it's making reference, you have to find that. But to begin with, it's not clear if Kim Yeon is making it up, or sometimes he did, or he is distorting the real references in the footnotes. Yeah,
it kind of reminds me of that genre of literature. I think they call it ergodic literature, which refers to readers having to make this non-trivial effort to navigate through a narrative. And so these footnotes are often not really there to add clarity or context, which is usually why we have footnotes, especially in the cases of translation. And, it's often there in this work to add another narrative or confuse the narrative in the main body of the text. One thing that I remember being interesting actually in the latter process of getting this work finished is some of the footnotes were signed translator by the author. And often actually these footnotes were the most quote unquote informative, as in that they would explain a certain reference in more detail. And I remember it confused our editor, and he would have in the manuscript, he was like, "You don't need this footnote in here." And I was like, no, that's actually not by us. That was memorable for sure.
Yeah, we ended up adding a real footnote that is helpful, saying that these footnotes saying these are by translators are not by translators.
Not by I laughed when I read that. But yeah, I love that you bring up that often we think of footnotes as explanatory, because I think definitely by the time I was through with this collection, I'd accepted that footnotes are not there to explain anything. That just became normal to me. And now that you mentioned it, I'm like, wait, maybe that is not generally how we think of footnotes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess speaking also of footnotes and some of what you two have talked about already, there's a real mix of cultural references throughout these poems, especially in the footnotes. And some of the references are Korean, but I think just as or even more often, there are references to American and other Western cultural icons, events, movies, and more. So many things that I'd never heard of, don't know much about it. So I'm glad to hear that it was also a struggle for you. It wasn't just me who was confused there's a lot happening in the world that I don't know about. But I was wondering if any of these references were particularly either difficult or even just surprising when it came to translating them.
I have a couple. So Tale of the Chishi Girl was basically incomprehensible to me.
Okay, I was about to say that. I was thinking about that as an example.
Yeah, go for it. I mean, so what I did find out was there's this reference to biographies of exemplary women, which is compiled by a Han Dynasty Confucian scholar, and it supposedly includes stories of exemplary women, and it's there to serve as moral education of Chinese women at the time. But it was clear that like the contents of the poem was subverting that, like it wasn't actually referring to one of the stories in the biographies of exemplary women. But I remember that was one of the poems that I think we had split up and I was supposed to translate it. And eventually I was like, Suhyun, I can't.
Yeah. I think this was the last poem we completed because we were both pretty frustrated with the poem. It took a lot of time to figure out how to do this. But yeah, as for the references, I think, you know, Western or American references, they were tricky, but they were manageable. Once you find the reference, a translation wasn't an issue because, well, American references are in English, right? Mm-hmm. But the challenging part was actually the non-American or non-European references. So the Tale of Chishi Girl, it's in the style of some kind of like a folktale, Korean or Chinese. When I say the reference here, it's not the reference to a story specifically, but the poet is making a reference to the style.
Mm-hmm.
And this was absolutely the hardest to figure out. Usually, a folktale has a pattern of plot. That makes it recognizably a folktale, but this one doesn't. You know, this one sounds like folktale because of the style, not because of its content. You know, period. And Korean folktales, for example, they aren't consciously Korean. It's written in Korean and it happened in Korea. And the same goes to Chinese folktales and all other folktales, but that's more of contingency that shapes the folktale. So the folktale doesn't itself shout, hey, this folktale is Korean. Mm-hmm. But for Kim Hyun's folktales, first, the plot isn't recognizably folktale-ish, and it's the language. And second, all the other poems in the collection are from the 20th century, 21st century, futuristic, American, and so forth. And this one is consciously Asian. Like, you know, this one is consciously Chinese. So I had to think a lot about how to deal with this kind of reference. So, stylistic reference. So I ended up putting Chinese characters in parentheses in the English translation to make the position of this poem clear, you know, the position within the collection clear. Which is clear to Korean readers. And I didn't want it to sound like a folktale like from basically anywhere. You know, it should sound like this one is from China. So if I were to translate a folktale that's like a standing alone, a real folktale, I wouldn't put Chinese characters. I would actually try my best to make it comfortable for English readers. But for this poem, I had to go exactly against that. And yeah, making all those kind of little decisions that can be influential, I think that was really hard.
Yeah, totally. I think that what you said about like if it's a Western reference, looking it up in English is actually not that it's not that hard. But the really tough thing about this is having to look this up in Korean and you know, possibly in Chinese, and my not having any knowledge in Chinese and in Korean, my, you know, I would say my research skills in Korean are not very good. I'm not good at skimming things. So when I had to read a Wikipedia article in Korean, I was like reading word for word, like, you know, sentence by sentence. And I was like, oh my gosh, I cannot, like, yeah, you know, parse what is happening here. So I was super grateful that Soo-hyun took that on. And I think the decisions that he made really brought the flavor of the poem out. One thing, you know, that, you know, you mentioned surprising, something that was surprising, I wanted to bring up, because this really did surprise me, was in that poem, Mr. Withers of Witheringwood, there's actually a direct reference to a poet named Lee Jin-hee, and her poem, 녹슨 시의 녹슨 기타, which in the poem is translated as Mr. Noxon's Rusty Guitar. And that poem is from her collection, Amado Africa, maybe Africa or perhaps Africa. And this is super interesting to me because I had actually just started reading Amado Africa at the time. And now, 2 years later, I'm actually translating that collection as part of the Alta Emerging Translators Mentorship Program, which I can talk about maybe at the end of this. But I emailed Lee Jin-hee and I was like, hey, you know, I helped translate Kim Hyun's Glory Hole. And there was this reference to your poem in the in his poem. And she was like, oh, yeah, we're really good friends. And yeah. He was like, he told me that he was referencing that poem, and that's so cool that you're translating his work. And I was like, whoa, what an interesting small world.
Thing about the references being in Korean, the problem is that these are like made up. So even fortunately, I know Chinese, but even so, since these were like fictitious, it's just like, you know, the reference wasn't there. It's like, you know, for example, in the first footnote, it says, "유방이 지원했던 연료구전." "유방," I think like when people hear Yubang in this context, for Korean people, they think about the Three Kingdoms. I think its name in Chinese should be Liu Fang. I got the accent wrong probably, but the pronunciation right. But yeah, so it's a person from the Three Kingdom. But when you see the Chinese characters, it's the Chinese characters for boobs, you know?
Yeah, I remember so, that part. Yeah.
So... all these kind of crazy things he did here, it's just impossible to like search on Google and, you know, trying to figure out. It's just like you're left alone and you have to figure out what to do by yourself. The only reference he gives is the style.
So I guess on the topic of like stylistic choices that you made as translators, there are points in Glory Hole where you have series of sentences where instead of periods or punctuation, you use capitalization to show separation between what would be sentences, like capitalizing the start of like a new thought or something. And this happens, for example, in the poem A Tribute to a Replicant, about which Gary mumbled. It also happens in like a number of other poems, I'm sure you remember. But then there are also places where you use lowercase, like in the poem Green Grass Disappeared. You use like a lowercase pronoun, I. But in Korean, like Hangul doesn't distinguish between separate lowercase or uppercase letters. And so I was wondering if you could just tell us a bit about what led to the decision to use capitalization in these ways.
I think the answer for one of those are, it's really simple. So the lowercase I in Green Grass Disappeared is actually Kim's choice. He used an alphabet lowercase I.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Korean. Yeah. So that's the name of the cyborg, actually. So that was pretty straightforward. And for other works, you know, dropping punctuation mark and using the capitalization, that was basically the, I think the Korean text didn't have punctuation marks. So the choice is between ignoring it and then like using a punctuation mark or dropping a punctuation mark. And I think it was right to drop the punctuation mark, because when you do so, you have different reading experience and you have to revive that experience for the English readers as well. So in Korean, when you drop a punctuation mark, it's still clear where the sentence ends because of the grammar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it usually ends with verb and it is conjugated. So you're going to read slower, but it's still going to be comprehensible. But what does change is the pace of your reading speed, or like, you know, how should I say? When you see a sentence end without a punctuation mark, you are pushed toward the next sentence.
Yeah, it's like a stream of consciousness.
Right, almost. Exactly. Right, yeah. I wanted to have that revived in the English translation. So I decided to drop the punctuation mark. But in English, when you drop a punctuation mark, it becomes almost incomprehensible. You know, the sentence can end with a noun, it can end with adverb, it can end with verb, and it becomes really hard to understand. And that's not necessarily what Korean readers are experiencing when they read Korean text. So I thought this is the right place to put capitalization, because in English, when you start a sentence, you start with a capitalization, like a capitalized letter. And in that way, English readers can have some kind of reference without having the punctuation mark. So that's why I put punctuation mark, capitalized letters, even though Korean doesn't have that.
Yeah, I think it works. And I love that about Korean, like the way the thoughts are kind of like you don't need the punctuation to have that unit. I think it's really beautiful about the language. And yeah, thank you for that. So I also was wondering, so there's a lot of like sexual language in the collection. And yet like in English, when it comes to sex, there's a lot of terms that can kind of refer to the same thing. And so I was wondering if it was ever challenging to decide like what words to use, what language to use, and what kinds of considerations shape your decisions as translators.
For me, you know, I can't recall specifics where I think I was debating between terms, but now that you kind of mention it, maybe I should have. I think I tried to keep what the tone of the poem was, and often there were sexual acts or terms described, but because there weren't really in a sexy way, I think that the language I also use tend to lean toward more neutral or clinical. I don't know if I have a great or interesting answer for that.
I'm basically the same. The thing is, Korean also has a different words for sex related terms. So Kim was usually making it, you know, formal, clinical, and if it did so, I followed it. For example, the poet intentionally used clinical terms in the footnote 6 of death. So I'll read the line. Here, the usage of the term is restricted to the act of heterosexual couple Gray and Bunny Smith, who, for the purposes of reproduction by means of sperm uniting with egg, inserted penis into vagina and through mutual friction resulted in instinctive ejaculation. So the original text was very dry, clinical, and awkward. So we tried to do the same in the translation. And the same goes to sad vagina. The term Kim chose was umbu, which is clinical, which is pretty clinical. Now the problem was which clinical term to use, because umbu refers to the female pubic area, not just vulva or vagina. And I chose vagina because first I wanted it to be more concise than like female genital or private part. And though vagina strictly refers to the passage and umbu a wider area, I thought the English and Korean readers usually think of the same area. or similar area when they hear the words. So I didn't have to be precise in that case. There were cases where Kim Hyun was using a more casual word, like, you know, 뚱뚱한 보지? And that is like basically pussy in English. I don't know if this is going to be censored.
I was going to say, we're going to have to put a not safe for work tag.
I feel a little bad that this might be censored. I don't know. But the choices were made according to what the poet was doing, and poet was pretty clear in his text.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thanks for that. And I love how I think both of you are describing kind of, because that's also the sense I got as a reader of like this, like it sounded like the language is kind of clinical, and then at the same time, like the poems themselves are like so mind-bending. And so
yeah, I think
that
yeah.
There's a tension there that like works together in a really complex and like kind of rich and beautiful way. And so I think both of you have kind of touched on this in various ways, but so these poems are really complex, as I think listeners have been hearing throughout this conversation, and they're rich both stylistically and in terms of subtext. And so I was wondering like how well you felt like you needed to understand a poem in order to translate it. And I know you've talked about this to an extent already. Like, how did you know that like I now know enough to translate this poem? Like,
oh man, that I relate strongly to this question. I was pretty obsessive about this, almost to the point that I think it was maybe detrimental to my own speed. I would find myself spending hours and hours chewing over a poem and, you know, just like trying to read everything there is about all of the references. And I would have to like try to resist you know, my own tendency to try to make things polished and beautiful and make it make sense. and I think what kind of helped me realize where to sort of stop with my own research and my own kind of turning this over in my head is just going back to like, what is the writer trying to achieve with this poem? And sometimes that question also was not clear to answer, but I sort of asked myself that at various stages. Sometimes that was the hardest part, actually, is because if you don't know how to answer that, then you're like, maybe more research will help me. I don't know if I have a great answer for this, but I feel like eventually you have a deadline to meet, so you can't, you can't spend forever reading about all the Americana and all of the. I was like, should I watch this movie? Should I, like, because he makes this, you know, Ash of the Time, that like, you know, that poem that I read is a reference to a Wong Kar-wai movie, and I was like, should I watch this? Should I like, do I need to, you know about this? So yeah. So anyways, yeah, that's my experience.
I think it was definitely important to understand the poems more so than the readers, but I guess I had a little bit lower expectation for myself, I guess. I was a little bit more relaxed because I believe that poets and authors themselves, they don't know what they are doing all the time, right? They go like, you know, they move intuitive moves sometimes, you know. They sometimes don't know why they are doing what they are doing. So I didn't think that was really important. If I can figure it out, it's good. But, you know, if I can't, I wasn't too worried about it. But and also, Kim Hyun, again, he was being pretty disruptive and unconventional and nebulous. So I took it for granted that some of his line is supposed to be incomprehensible. But I thought it is important to know what is not making sense, right? So you don't have to know why the poet made the line incomprehensible, or why it should be, how it should be comprehended, even. But if it doesn't make sense, you have to know what is making that line incomprehensible, because you have to translate that. You have to translate that experience. So whenever I was confused and couldn't figure out what's going on, I was trying to capture what is confusing in this poem. And, you know, try to recreate the device and effect the poet used to make it confusing.
Yeah, that's such a lovely way of putting it. Yeah, so Sion and Archana, we have taken up a lot of your time. So I have just one last question for both of you. What are you working on next?
Perhaps I gotta go first, because, you know, I have nothing. She has more things going on. I'm not working on anything particular at this moment. I'm trying to focus on my research. And once my research is on track, I'll get back to poetry translation But for now, I'm not doing anything.
Do you want to tell us about
stay
your research
tuned.
At all?
Stay tuned. I'll be back.
On my end, so I was chosen this year to be a part of the American Literary Translators Association. Wow, that is a mouthful. American Literary Translators Association's Emerging Translators Mentorship Program for Korean Poetry, funded through LTI Korea. And I'm translating poetry by Lee Jenny from her collection Amado Africa, and I've been working with Jack Jung, a poet and translator of Isang's work, and that has been really lovely. And you know, I've been corresponding with Lee Jenny about her translations, and have gotten some poems published, and I'm working on some of the rest in that collection. And I've also been translating fairly regularly with Korean Literature Now, which is a quarterly literary magazine published by the Literature Translation Institute of Korea, translating some of the best young, actually all female so far for the works that I've done, all female writers of the last couple of years. So that has been a lot of fun, and you know, I'm kind of grateful that I have the opportunity to keep translating poetry and prose, and it's been exciting.
Congratulations. And I'm so grateful that we get to read more of your work, because it's really exciting.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah. So thank you so much for joining me here today, both of you.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for inviting us.
Yeah. And take care, everyone, to our listeners.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.